Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of November. The first Hmong American Studies courses will be offered in 2014 at UW-Madison with Professor Yang Xiao Zhang, hired as the first tenure-track professor in the country in this subject matter. He's going to teach and research the Hmong American experience. What has been the experience of Hmong refugees and their descendants in the United States? He said that Hmong Americans are at a stage where they want to focus on critical issues affecting them, poverty, health, race, and politics, just like many other social movements. As more Hmong students attended UW, they were petitioning the university to develop coursework to enable them and other students to learn about Hmong heritage and culture as part of their academic training. Two of those people who led the community advocacy effort are also with us for this discussion this hour. Peng Her, who's director of South Madison Promise Zone, an initiative launched by Madison's Urban League to elevate the quality of life of the children in the city's South Side neighborhoods. Also, Maizong Vu will also be with us, a tireless advocate for the poor for the past 30 years. Maizong Vu's advocacy and grassroots activism led to the development of Hmong and refugee women nonprofit agencies in Wisconsin and in Georgia, and she has served on boards nationally and internationally. We'll be welcoming phone calls. There is a significant Hmong population, as you know, in the state of Wisconsin. Some of you may not be aware of the history of how the Hmong came to our state and to Minnesota and California, where they are in the largest numbers. And so we will tell that story and welcome your phone calls. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Yang Xiao Zheng also holds a joint appointment in the School of Social Work and the Asian American Studies Program, and comes to UW-Madison after completing his PhD in sociology at UCLA. He is spending this academic year on a postdoctoral fellowship. And we thank you all so much for being with us. It should be a most interesting hour for us. If we could please, let's start with you, Peng Her and Maizong Vu, as to the efforts that you undertook to get this program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. It was a full-fledged effort, wasn't it? Maizong, would you like to start?
The Hmong studies topic today. Yes, it has been quite an effort from the Hmong community to ensure that we have a place to call home at an institution like UW-Madison. And so we're very pleased about the effort. As you said in your introduction, Wisconsin is home to the third largest Hmong in the nation. Mm-hmm. And we are very pleased to be here as Wisconsinites for the last 30 years or so. Hmong in Wisconsin, as you may already know, are pretty much scattered throughout Wisconsin, concentrating in about 15 counties, with Milwaukee, of course, being the largest, to anywhere from Wausau, Madison, Sheboygan, Green Bay, the Fox City area, to Eau Claire and Manitowoc. And for those who read census data, you probably know that the Hmong community is a very young community in terms of age, economic, education, politic, and social adaptation issues. And we felt pretty much like we need to make sure that the Hmong American experiences in Wisconsin are studied, researched on, and being taught to students at places like UW-Madison. So we're very happy that this is the whole reason why the whole community came together and worked on this effort for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Maizong, could you tell us, I just am interested in people's family histories, how your family came to the United States and when?
Sure. I came to the United States in February of 1980. Originally, we were sponsored by a Lutheran church in Illinois, and for 2 weeks, my sister, who had been in Kimberley, Wisconsin, 5 years earlier than we did relocated us to Wisconsin after she heard where we were. And so I grew up in Kaukauna and went to high school up there and then came down to Madison to work. So our family came together in three different phases. First, my sister's family, and then my mom, and then my dad, and the other half of my family came a year later. So Wisconsin has been a home to the rest of my family since then.
Mm-hmm. Ping Her, tell me about your efforts to get this program at Madison and a little bit about how your family and when your family arrived in Wisconsin.
Sure. So my family first arrived in the States in 1975. So we were one of the first wave of the Hmong who came in December of 75. And my family actually settled in Iowa. And so after growing up in Iowa, I went to school in Chicago, graduate school, and then moved up here to Madison a little over 12 years ago. And that's how I came to Wisconsin and into Madison. And so it's been a long, long journey, but worthwhile to be in a place like Madison here.
Mm-hmm. And what about the efforts to get this program in the school in Madison? Did you work on that as well? You must be pretty happy to see it come to fruition.
Yeah, I mean, this initiative really started with the students, the Hmong students, as well as non-Hmong students, and the larger Hmong community here in Madison. You know, starting back in the mid-1990s when they were first exposed to the UW, and many of the Hmong elders and the veterans who protested the misportrayal of General Vang Pao through one of the books a professor here wrote. And then you fast forward to 2007 when there was the Losco incident. And so as more and more students, Hmong students came to campus, and more of us as parents, I realized that study shows that if there's a culturally relevant teaching style, that students are grounded in their home language as well as their home culture, they do so much better in education and also bridges into their career. So we wanted to create a program that really helped ground the Hmong students as well as non-Hmong students about who the Hmong are, their heritage, their culture, and to help and let that help them succeed in their academics. Because that's, I think, at the point of it, everybody wants that. They want successful students attending this University of Madison so that they can go out and become productive citizens in this world and in this global community. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the impetus of how we the force behind this movement.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Zhang, is Hmong American Studies a brand new program, a brand new discipline in the academic world?
Well, hi, Kathleen. It's a pleasure
hi.
To be here.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for that question. Hmong American Studies is a fairly new field. Now, other universities and colleges, say, for example, Concordia University in Minnesota, has a Hmong American Studies program. There at UW, we do not currently have a formal program or center. What we do have is my position in the scholarship that I plan to produce and the courses that I also plan to develop.
Could you please, or whoever wants to answer this question, I think there are a lot of people who don't understand how the Hmong came to the United States. It was not under the best of circumstances. Can you give us that historical reference?
I'd be very happy to. Most of the foreign-born Hmong in the U.S. Were born in either Laos or Thailand. They were part of a secret war in Laos within the larger umbrella of the American-Vietnam War. It was a secret war in Laos because under the Geneva Accords, the U.S., other countries were not supposed to be in Laos. Hmong were recruited by the U.S. CIA in about 1960 and 61. They then recruited an army, specifically an army of about 30 to 40,000 strong, who were supposed to block the Ho Chi Minh Trail, rescue down American pilots, and fight on the U.S. side. And so in the mid-1970s, after the war in Laos and Vietnam, as well as in Cambodia, were lost, the U.S. pulled out, Hmong became displaced refugees in Thailand, and that's how since the mid-1970s, Hmong have made their way to the U.S. Of course, not all Hmong made it immediately to the U.S. In fact, the majority of them spent years or decades in Thailand refugee camps before they could be admitted to the U.S., Canada, Australia, France, a few in Germany.
In if I can just also add on to the whole resettlement piece, I think looking in the history of the United States, refugees who came to America has been scattered in clusters of certain population. And it wasn't until the Southeast Asian refugees that came in the 70s that really formalized the refugee programs in the United States, where the Refugee Act of 1980 is pretty much the beginning of formalizing a whole refugee under Congress in the United States. So that's how the Hmong came, and they came under this Refugee Act of 1980 that are pretty much a church sponsorship program where wherever the church is willing to accept the refugee, that's where they come to. And oftentimes, you know, people always ask, oh, my goodness, Wisconsin is so cold. Why do you choose Wisconsin? And I always say, I didn't choose Wisconsin. Wisconsin chose me. And so that's how the arrival of Hmong in Wisconsin takes place. The other piece that we have, if you look at demographically and geography-wise in Wisconsin, the spread of the 15 county has to do with a lot of the Hmong clan systems, where in each community that now has a large Hmong community, it's like a magnet where that person, that clan leader, glues the rest of his family to join him. So that's how the combination of the church sponsorship and the clan leaders kind of shaped the location of where the Hmong are in Wisconsin.
There must have been a certain amount of anger, if that's the correct word, at the United States for leaving so many people in refugee camps in Thailand when we asked the Hmong to fight for us in the Vietnam War. That doesn't quite seem right, does it?
Well, I would just, got to say something, and then Yashou can answer the rest on that. For the veterans that we are working with in terms of the our parents who fought in the war, yes, they felt a certain pain in terms of saying, well, when the United States wanted us to fight for them, they didn't ask for our citizenship. But now how come we have to become citizens to get this benefit, that benefit, and so forth? So there is still that strong resentment from the parents. Of course, for the kids, we don't have as strong a resentment as our parents do. And Yashou can add too,
Right. To add to what Majo and I said earlier, so Hmong are a unique group. Like other Southeast Asian or Indo-Chinese refugees of the mid-1970s, they came as political refugees. So they're not your economic migrants that we may find and elsewhere in other countries such as China or Korea or Japan. We have a group who, through war and destruction, came with basically just the clothes on their back with very limited resource. And so Hmong and Laotians, Cambodians, and Vietnamese need to be understood within this as a political refugee group rather than just an immigrant group.
And how difficult it must have been for those early years for your parents' generation to come to a country where there were certainly not very many Hmong at all, to a place that's freezing cold, snowing in the winter, and to such a completely different culture. That's a large task to come to such a place, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I'll share a couple stories that I have heard and really enjoyed learning about those time. Is one of the second Hmong who arrived in Wisconsin as the first Hmong families. When I interviewed him for a project that I was doing, and I asked him about, well, what was your first reaction to Appleton when you first arrived? And he said, when I got here, it was dead winter in January, and nobody is outside. Oh. And I thought to myself, my goodness, how come this country, everybody hides in their house and they don't go out at all? And I couldn't understand why. And then I didn't know where I was going, and I didn't know how to read the street signs. So how I learned my neighborhood is I would step outside, walk on the snow, not on the sidewalk, and go for one block and then come back, trace my footstep back mm-hmm. to my home. And then the next day, I would do the same thing. And each day, I would further edit, you know, the blocks. So within the month, I know my neighborhood in around, and this is in Appleton. And so he's talking about learning that within a month where his surrounding is and trying to memorize where his new home is. So that's how everybody have to start learning their new surrounding, their new neighbors, and so forth. So, mm-hmm. yes, it is quite difficult.
I thought I'd just also add that, you know, when you come from a culture that believes in animism and spirits, so imagine yourself coming to Madison, Wisconsin, and your first night is October 31st.
You know, oh, my
goodness.
You just
celebrated Halloween.
Right.
So you look out your window, and you have all these ghosts and goblins roaming the streets. How much of a shock would that be to your to who you are and your giving up your homeland, giving up your family
right.
to come all the way to a country that you never been to or never speak the language. So it is challenging in those early years. But at the same time, what we also wanted to do is show about the rich history and the culture that the Hmong community have because, as we mentioned before, the involvement of the Hmong into the Vietnam War was very due to the Geneva Accord and being recruited by the CIA. And so for us, we call it the Vietnam War. And for folks in Southeast Asia, they call it the American War. And for the Hmong, we call it the Secret War because to the rest of America, it was a secret that the United States was involved in this conflict in Laos because of the Geneva Accord. So we want an opportunity to share that history. And as 30 years has expired since the end of the Vietnam War, more and more of the documents from the Department of Defense and the White House are being released, and we're getting more and more information about what those discussions took place back in the early 60s and 70s so that we can then begin to tell the story so that those who don't know who the Hmong are can begin to learn about their neighbors next door.
Right. Well, they should certainly learn about them by now. Professor Zhang, let me ask you, I know that you are studying Hmong social movements in the United States and examining social movement theory. So you're looking at how the Hmong compare with other social movements in this country. What's unique about Hmong social movement?
I think they certainly share a lot of similarities with other ethnic racial groups, but there's also some unique things. Hmong, for example, brought with them a particular discourse, and part of that discourse has been hinted to earlier on. That discourse has to do with their historical relationship with the U.S. CIA, the U.S. government. And so in many of these social movements or protest movements that Hmong veterans, Hmong seniors have been engaged in, for example, the anti-welfare reform movements of the mid-1960s, Hmong have had to use a particular discourse. In my work, I call that the military service framing. They have, in a way, had to present their military service in order so that the government would even begin to listen to them. We saw a similar framing happening when Hmong in the late 1990s, they were also fighting to get naturalization accommodations. Hmong, too, in those instances, had to use a military service framing. And so unlike other immigrants, Hmong had to rely on this particular framing, this particular discourse during some of their movements.
And does that framing mean you had to present it that way in order to be eligible for such things as health benefits?
No, I would think that framing works in certain contexts, works in the sense that it applies. It may or may not be applicable to other cases.
I see. We welcome phone calls for our guests. We have three of them today who are joining us from our studios in Madison. We were interested in the story that the first Hmong American Studies courses will be offered next fall at UW-Madison. The first tenure-track professor in the country in this subject matter is with us this hour. He'll be teaching. He's getting the courses and research together right now. Professor Yang Xiao Zheng is with us. And also joining us is Peng He, director of the South Madison Promise Zone. and also who's been very active in getting this program at UW-Madison. And Mai Zhang Vu has been an advocate for the poor for the past 30 years, especially the Hmong refugees. She has worked on boards nationally and internationally. Here's our phone number. We're looking specifically at the Hmong in Wisconsin, although our guests can answer questions about Hmong populations elsewhere. We've just briefly talked about the history of why the Hmong came to Wisconsin, because it's not a place you would think from a tropical kind of climate to come to Wisconsin must have been extremely difficult. We'll look at education, how Hmong are faring. Many of them are going on now to college and to post-college experiences. How has public education worked? What are the special health concerns of Hmong? One of our guests made reference to an incident, somebody in the law school saying something pretty sensational back in 2007. Are there incidents, many of them, of cultural insensitivity? And if so, what are they? And what do we do about that? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two phone calls now for our guests, and we start with Kay in Mukwonago. Hi, Kay.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been out of this loop for a while, but in 1980, I volunteered with the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, through Fredert, and a group of us, I'm a nurse, went to Thailand, and I worked at Ban Miao, which was in the northern part of Thailand, in the camp there for 2 months. Mm. And it was a life-changing experience for me. I had no idea what people go through when they have to leave their country and when the cultures are so dissimilar, and to come here from a tropical country into the cold. When I came home, I helped to sponsor several families, and I can remember going to the airport in the middle of winter and people getting off the airplane unaware of how cold it was, just with little flip-flops on in their cotton clothes. And I've had many experiences in the past with Hmong refugees. I think in the beginning, when I worked in Milwaukee as a nurse, many people were being taken advantage of by unscrupulous landlords and things like that. I tried to help with that. And being a nurse, I had looked into the shamanism and animism and things like that. So I worked in clinics trying to help people understand when they came in for treatment, you know, the differences and things like that. I worked with a man named Victor in Milwaukee who I've lost track of, who helped me a lot. But anyway, I'm glad you're having this program, and I'm so happy to hear that this is going to start at the University of Wisconsin. And I'll just hang up and listen to the comments.
Thank you very much. Probably, Mai Zhang Vu, your comments, response to Kay.
Thank you. Thank you, Kay, for sharing your experience. It is individuals like yourself that make our adjustment much easier in terms of the climate change, the language, the neighborhood, and so forth. So I'm very thrilled that you are among one of those many who are have done that. And I think you may be referring to Victor Xiong. If you are, he is still around in Milwaukee, and I'd be happy to connect you with him if you like.
Oh, that's great.
So I just, I just want to share that stories like Kay's or stories that we are trying to collect and understand, you know, the embracing of the other side to the community, because when the Hmong came to Wisconsin in the 80s, with the gap of the language, the culture, and so forth, people just survive without truly understanding what's going on. So, for example, in the mental health field, I always share the story that when the Hmong arrived in the 1980s, sponsors are so happy to celebrate every holiday with them. And so, for example, come July 4th, which is the proudest holiday in the United States, to be celebrating with firework. And when they take their Hmong families to this wonderful celebration of wonderful firework, what they found out in the particular family is that the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress comes back where the firework, you know, brings them back to gunshots, you know, bomb dropping and so forth. And the family just have to, you know, leave, and they didn't understand why. And so, you know, this whole celebration turned into a nightmare for their family. So stories like these are in a time where people don't understand each other. They don't understand what people are going through. Someone's happy that they're there and they're sharing their happiness, but it may be the other, you know, side of that.
Let's
the
talk
other way.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say another part that we also adjust a lot with is our parents' way of communicating. You know, looking at someone in the Western way means paying attention. And to the parents, that means you're rude because you stare at me all the time. You know, so things like these are, you know, things that we have to learn to adjust to each other.
I believe it was you, Peng He, who made reference to comments by a law school professor back in 2007, which points to cultural insensitivity. Is that still a large problem? Has that been a large problem? Do you have examples of that?
I think overall it's going to continue to be a problem because we as humans, we have a biases towards other cultures as well as oftentimes we feel uncomfortable stepping outside of our own boxes. So race relations or discrimination, that's always going to be a problem for humans as long as we, I think, as long as we exist. But I think what we wanted to do is also share that the Hmong community is a really rich culture. And, you know, when you come from humble beginnings, as I like to say, from a country that's very poor, underdeveloped, and your culture is based on agriculture, and then you end up living in camps, Mon Vinai, which is one of the largest one. You know, it's 400 acres, and at the peak of it is 45,000 people living there. So when I talk to students, I have them imagine going to Camp Randall Stadium and living with all those fans for many, many years in a location where there's limited resources for everyone, whether it's sleeping or water. And so fast-forwarding to now, where we want to make sure that whether it's the university or hospitals being culturally relevant. And Kay mentioned about being in the medical field. And what we want this Hmong American Studies to be able to do is do research on these things so that as the Hmong bring their cultural practices in healthcare, for example, and shamanism, that the medical world, Western medicine, also take into consideration these cultural competencies so that it's a patient-centered and the medical practice really pertains to the cultural belief of that person. So if that person may not believe in surgery because we believe in the afterlife and being reincarnated, the doctor takes that into consideration as they're making a diagnosis for that person.
Hmm, interesting. I'm interested in hearing a little bit more. I know, Professor Zhang, this is one of your areas of research. What's happened with young people as they go through the American education system that the vast majority of Hmong American students attend public schools. I've spoken at a charter school, public charter school that was all Hmong a couple of years ago, and it was a fascinating experience. And you're beginning to notice, which I guess would make sense, signs of improvement in terms of students staying through high school and in terms of students going on to college, aren't you?
I think across the board, Hmong, whether in Wisconsin or Minnesota or California, have made tremendous improvements during the past 20 or 10 years. There are challenges remaining, I think, though, challenges that many other students besides Hmong face, whether it's about having to take out loans, doing well on tests of English skills or academic standards tests. Hmong, too, struggle with these types of issues. So there's certainly improvements, but there are also remaining challenges.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls. Joyce in Rothschild. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having this wonderful program. I was part of Even Start Family Literacy. It was a partnership between the Wausau School District and North Central Technical College, and I was one of the adult instructors. And the focus of the program was the family, and we had intergenerational programming, and it was the best experience I've ever had. And I agree with the former caller. It changed my life. It changed my outlook. And my students were mostly women, but at the end there were more men. But I just, every time I think of even Start Family Literacy and my Hmong students, my heart just is warm. So thank you again for having such a great program, and good luck on the new program at UW.
Thank you so much. Professor Jean?
Go ahead. Thank you so much for that, too. I'd like to add and maybe perhaps expand on this issue of education. A lot of my work certainly deals with English learners in California's public schools, and since I've been here, I've been asked to give a couple of talks on the issue of English learners in Wisconsin. And so because of No Child Left Behind, Hmong students, Spanish speakers, Vietnamese speakers, they're in some cases, overrepresented as English learners, and a lot of my research has tried to understand the processes and the practices that draw their authority from federal policies like No Child Left Behind. What's happening? And so my research looks at how they are surveyed and how they are classified and then how they're tested and how they're tracked and how these processes or practices together lead to perhaps unintended consequences for English learners. Consequences like not being able to take college prep courses, not being able to enroll in honors English or math, and which in turn may have a long-term impact on their access to college. So these are some of the things I mean when I say that there are remaining challenges facing Hmong and other minority students.
Forgive me if this is a stereotype, but it's a good stereotype. I did speak, as I mentioned, at a school. There's a Hmong, I don't know if it's a charter school or just part of the MPS school system, a couple years ago, and it was first grade all the way through high school. And I must tell you, I was absolutely astounded by how interested everybody was in what was going on in their classrooms. You could have heard a pin drop in the hallways. Everybody was just ready to go to learn more. Was I experiencing just an unusual school, or was I experiencing something that you may see in a school that has mostly Hmong students? It was quite impressive.
I would say that if you have engaging teachers, and you have rigorous and exciting curricula to go with that, then I don't see. It's not surprising at all to see that students would be very engaged, very attentive, very mindful of what's going on in the classroom, outside. So that if we have those types of ingredients, engaged teachers, rigorous curricula, then I wouldn't find that surprising. But I'm very glad to hear that.
Catherine, and yes. I also want to add, I think what you experience is one of the very unique one where you see everyone as together. So you have the experience of a compact experience of everybody together, whereas in scattered schools where there's fewer Hmong and then a lot of other kids, you still have that manner of being respectful and listen to the teacher and pay attention to the teacher, but you may not notice as much because it's not every single one of them. So I think I wanted to make a point that when I talk to my teachers, still nowadays when I talk to my son's teacher, the comment of Hmong students tend to have a big focus on the teacher, listening to the teacher and well behave. I think that is still a contribution from our parents, where they focus a lot about respecting authority versus being the argumented individualistic point of view. And mm-hmm. so that is something where I see as a strength that we still bring, trying, you know, to the mainstream, where in the mainstream it may have been lost for, you know, a couple of generations.
Mm-hmm.
So,
it's interesting.
Yeah, so your experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we can learn from each other's cultures, because there's probably also
definitely
something to be said for dissent and for questioning authority occasionally, right?
Exactly. And that's very hard for me as a parent, you know, raising kids now in this society where you're trying to bring in that strength where everything should be focused as a group. And when you make a decision, you need to you know, make sure that you don't make a decision that's going to just benefit yourself, but who do you impact in the long term? And at school, your kids are being taught to, you know, be the me, 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 I attitude. And it's a very hard thing for us, you know, as parents to juggle between what we value and what we have.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mohammed in Cedarburg. Hi.
Hi. First of all, Niao Zhong. I am so fascinated by your program, and then first thing of which I am also an immigrant, of course. I am a retired physician, and I had several hundreds and hundreds of Hmong patients in my practice in Milwaukee. But what I'm trying to really delineate and rather underscore the phenomenon that this has been 5 decades, 50 years ago, that Hmong people fought for the United States with their blood. And imagine that this is just for, and I hope the panel would agree with me, that so many Hmongs are still stranded in Thailand in these refugee camps, and we have simply not acknowledged these people because this was a secret war of CIA. The law was passed in the 1980s, and how many difficulties they had. I'm trying to make a kind of a juxtaposing this immigration of people who gave their lives for the United States in one column, and those of those are the Anglo type of immigrants who came here from all over the place, and the difficulties the Hmong people had in this country over the last 5 decades. And none of your panel has an accent, because they're fluent. I mean, I could go on and on and on. But one final question. I mean, their language is absolutely fascinating. The script is Latin. But, you know, when I hear you people on the radio, of course you sound like Americans. But when you are in practice, you know, people stand out, and there's so much discrimination, even today after 5 decades. And that's sad. As a nation, we should really look at people who gave their lives for the United States. Mm. I just wanted to point out the insensitivity that goes on in our society, and I hope we learn from the Hmong experience. Same thing happened to the Japanese Americans when we interned them during the Second World War. So I can go on and on and on, but I would hang up and listen to
it. Thank you, Mohammed. Thanks very much for the call. There are still refugee camps, Professor Zhang?
Certainly. In the latest wave we had coming from Wat Thaugrabong in Thailand, we had about 14,000 to 15,000 Hmong, who are the most recent wave of political refugees. Now, we don't know if in the future the U.S. will admit any further political refugees. We do not, I do not have a specific number of how many political refugees are left in Thailand, but there are certainly some still left behind in Thailand.
Mm-hmm. And Kathleen,
ahead.
So maybe just add it on to the whole refugee issue. And thank you, Mohammed, for your comments. I think the thing that Mohammed brought about the policy that affects the Hmong refugees are something that needed to be explored and researched more and look at the impact of how the secret war has impacted the Hmong who are still stranded overseas, which is Thailand and other countries that they chose to stay because A, they can't come, or B, they chose not to come. And so the whole policy has to do with United Nations, United High Commissioner for Refugee. They are the organization that makes policy about who is a refugee and who is not. And for the Hmong, anybody who arrived, you know, from Laos to Thailand after 1987 are not considered refugee status. They are considered displaced people. So, of course, a lot of Hmong who left Laos after 1987 to any part of the refugee camps in Thailand have a hard time coming to a third world country because they don't have that legal status within United High Commissioner, and that's what he's talking about, and that's a whole subject itself that
right. We
can certainly talk at a different time.
Yeah, Kathleen, this is Bing. I just wanted to comment on Mohammed's comments that, it is true that the Hmong community here in the U.S. is such a great It's a great opportunity for scholars to really research and study them because they do so much in regards to race relations, whether it's domestically here in Wisconsin, where we had the hunting incidences up in northern Wisconsin as a way to discuss race relations here in Wisconsin, as well as internationally. The Hmong community, because of the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam has been a very dark part of U.S. history. A lot of folks still don't discuss that, or we haven't brought closure to that. And so because of that, the Hmong have been a fallout of that. And so even today, recently in 2011 and 12, several thousand Hmong who were in Thailand as refugees were repatriated back into Laos. And this is the first time in modern history that a ethnic group who fled a country for political asylum was repatriated back. And so and this is so important because Hillary Clinton, Senator Clinton there in 2000 or last year, visited Laos for the first time in 30, 40 years that a U.S. High-ranking officer such as a Secretary of State visited. And she brought up two points that she addressed with the Lao government. One was the damming of the Mekong River and the environmental impacts it has on that country. And the second point she brought up was she wanted to know how the Hmong were doing who were repatriated back. So of all the topics that she could have discuss with the Lao government, she brought up the Hmong issue. And so even though a Hmong may be a very small ethnic group, whether in the U.S. or globally, it's still a ethnic group that plays a significant role in U.S. foreign policy and into the future also.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about a lot of things, but our conversation prompted by UW-Madison offering in the fall, it will begin in 2014, the first Hmong American Studies program. This is a program that the activists in the Hmong community had been working to get established for quite some time, and by golly, they did it, and it's going to happen in about a little less than a year from now. We have three guests with us. Professor Yang Sao Zheng is in the School of Social Work and the Asian American Studies program, comes to UW-Madison after completing his PhD in sociology at UCLA. Peng He is also with us, director of the South Madison Promise Zone, an initiative launched by Madison's Urban League to elevate the quality of life of the children in the city's Southside neighborhoods. He most recently served as executive director of the East Isthmus Neighborhoods Planning Council, a former business owner, and much, much more. And actually, all their resumes are so long, it would take forever to read them. So just a little bit about their very active lives. Mai Zhang Vu has been an advocate for the poor for the past 30 years. She has done Hmong and refugee women nonprofit work, organizing agencies, developing them, really, in Wisconsin and Georgia. She served on boards nationally and internationally and has won many awards for serving the poor. More phone calls momentarily. Mohammed, thanks for yours. And there are a couple lines open. Our lines have been busy, but there is a chance for you to grab a phone line right now if you would like. Our number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls, Lynn and Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen and guests. There's a certain segment of white American society who will always refer to anyone who's not a blue, white, blonde as those people. We have a city councilman who refers to, the 30-year-old Hmong population here in Eau Claire as those people. And I wasn't raised that way. We were reminded, that from the Great Starvation, that when our families came here, it was no black nor Irish need apply. Or my Polish family, they fled from a pogrom. And because we can blend in, it doesn't make our experiences any different. We can just hide amongst ourselves. And if any segment of the American population is marginalized, then the whole nation is marginalized, and it brings shame to me.
Thank you, Lynn, for your call. Whoever would like to respond.
Thank you, Lynn, for your comment. It is always good to know that there are allies and there are those who feel, you know, uncomfortable with people who don't look like them. So I value your comment and thank you. And Eau Claire, you know, for the most part, has been a wonderful community that has made a lot of history in Wisconsin in terms of electing Hmong individuals to be city council, councilmen, school board. And so I think there's gradual acceptance of Hmong in Wisconsin in the Eau Claire area, which is something to be proud. And I know that there will always be those people who say those people. But for me, I think it's great to focus on the strength of what the Hmong, you know, bring to this state and to those who look for common interests rather than focusing on the differences from each other. So I appreciate your call and thank you for your support.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Zhang, I know that you've written about the persistent racial stereotypes that often associate young men who are Hmong with socially deviant behavior like gang behavior. Those stereotypes are hard to die off, aren't they?
Certainly. I think that you have, on one hand, sometimes Hmong being grouped in the what we in Asian American studies call the model minority category. And then on the other hand, you have other people, whether that's in academia, out on the streets or in the media, calling or labeling Hmong youth, especially Hmong youth boys or men, young men, as deviant, gang-related. So these two very divergent, contrasting images often get thrown out there without much discussion. And so part of my course will try to do is to bring a more critical discussion around the various groups that make up this category of Asian Americans. And given what we talked about earlier, that not all groups came with the same types or amounts of resources, not all of them also have the same life chances in the U.S. And so part of my courses within the larger Asian American Studies program will be to help students at our university, not just Asian American students, all students better understand diversity in a critical way, diversity beyond just language or culture. We're talking about racial diversity, ethnic diversity. And I really see our movement, our Hmong American Studies movement, as part of a larger UW-Madison movement for diversity and creating diversity and creating inclusion.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Kenneth, our final phone call. We're running short on time. Kenneth, hi.
I'm just so happy to say this, and that there are very few Americans that really understand how much these people gave to our country in that war. And that we promised them that we would not lose, and they bet their lives and their sacred honor on us, and fought harder than we did in that war, and suffered more casualties, and paid a lot higher price than we did. I'm just so happy to say that. And this is, you know, 40 years too late. I mean, the university position.
Thanks, Kenneth, for your call. Professor Zhang, you get the last 30 seconds.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. I really appreciate you inviting us to talk here. We really appreciate, too, the support from the UW leadership, from the chancellor, the deans, the provost, who have for a number of years now, or even decades, tried really hard to promote and do very tangible activities that promote inclusion, diversity. The Hmong American community in Madison, as well as across the state of Wisconsin, have taken that role very seriously in a number of years. And so my position, the tenure track assistant professor position, represents one effort from the Hmong community and from the UW-Madison to hopefully, in the number of years to come, create more diversity, mm-hmm. promote inclusion, create a better opportunities for our students to learn about each other's cultures so that they can become better, more productive citizens.
Yeah, thank you.
A more global thing. So
thank you. Thank you all so much. It was really a very interesting, Very interesting hour, and Kenneth's point is well taken. Some things happen long after the time they should have happened, but at least they happen. Talking this hour about the first at UW-Madison, starting next fall, the first Hmong American Studies program. Thanks to KP Whaley and Robin Cherry for producing this program.